Accession number 8192, rule number 7.
Brigadier Barclay, rule 7. I think you eventually ended up on the Albert Turnut Canal.
I did. The intervening stopping lines were held without incident until, in fact, we withdrew to the Albert Turnut Canal and the River Esco near Tournai. And here, during the night, we took over from a battalion of the Royal Berkshire Regiment and strengthened and improved the positions during the course of the night. These positions were on a fairly wide front as far as my company was concerned. I know the battalion had a very long front to contend with, and so, of course, my company front was also a long one. It was, I suppose, about 700 or 800 yards, very nearly, which was a lot for a company in close area, in close country. There were buildings on our side of the canal, and there was a plantation on the enemy side of the canal. So we had to have a pretty effective system of crossfire.
Did you have any artillery in support?
Oh, yes, we had our artillery in support. They were in position and ready to function, I know, by the time we were in position. And the preparation, my preparation, my company preparations were completed during hours of darkness, and I went round, and they were jolly well camouflaged too, and some were in cellars so that they had sort of loopholes in just under the roofs of cellars, which were marvellous positions. There was one lot I remember firing through loopholes behind a garden wall, one or two slightly back from the river bank, but they were well concealed positions and gave a good cover of the frontage I was responsible for. Anyhow, having satisfied myself on the company layout, my batman reported that he'd seen some black rabbits in the park of the chateau in the grounds of which some of my positions were. And not only that, but he'd found some ferrets in a box in the stables. I'm ashamed to say there were also a couple of retrievers kept shut up in the stables, and all the occupants of the chateau and everybody else round about had departed, except in a little convent nearby where the two nuns had remained. So we thought we'd get in a bit of sport before the fun began. And I had a shotgun with me, and we popped these ferrets down a big warren, and we were having a rabbit sport as rabbits bolted out of these berries, when after about an hour and a half of this, shelling started along the river line generally, and we came in for a certain amount of this, and we thought, well, we'd better pack this up now and deal with the other situation. So back we went to company quarters and waited for the next pattern of activities. And after a few hours, some Germans appeared on the far bank. They were totally oblivious of our presence in the immediate vicinity. And I told my soldiers on no account were any of them to fire until they heard my hunting horn. And an officer appeared and got his map out, and he would appear to be holding an O group with his senior warrant officers or whoever they were. And then they withdrew into the wood, and we heard a lot of chopping going on. And we saw tops of trees flattening out. And in fact, what they were doing was cutting down young trees to make a long series of hurdles to lay over the top of the blitzed bridge, which was in the middle of my sector. There were bits of concrete lying across the canal. You couldn't walk across, but with the use of... They were so placed along the river that across the canal that with hurdles, suitable length of hurdles, pedestrians have been able to get across. And eventually they emerged from this plantation with a number of long hurdles made up of these saplings. And they proceeded to lay these across the rubble, the remains of concrete blocks in the canal. So we kept quite quiet. There's still no idea we were there. And I reckon we'd wait until there were as many as we could contend with on our side of the canal before opening fire. And there were SS with black helmets, and they started to come across, and we waited for a posse of them to accumulate on our side. They were still convinced that there were there was no problem about adversaries in the area. And they were standing about in little groups waiting for larger parties to get across. And then I reckon just about as many as we could contend with. So I blew my hunting horn, and then all the soldiers opened fire with consummate accuracy and disposed of all the enemy personnel on our side of the canal and also the ones on the bank on the far side, which brought, obviously, hostile proceedings to an abrupt halt. And then, of course, we came in for an inordinate amount of shelling and mortar fire. And not so long after that, I was wounded in the guts and in the back and in my arm. And we'd had several casualties before this, and all the stretchers were therefore out. And my batman, with great presence of mind, ripped a door off its hinges, and in spite of my orders to the contrary, tied me onto this door. In fact, had he not done this, I probably wouldn't be here to tell the tale. But there I was, tied to this door, and I said, all right, well, now you've got to take me round on this door. You've not only got my way to contend with, but you've got the door as well. And so, of course, that took four people. And they took me round on this door to deal with what has become a very threatening situation from our right flank, where there should have been a unit of our own, another battalion, but they'd either left or else they'd moved from the immediate vicinity of my right flank, which we had been in contact with. And instead of a friendly unit being there, suddenly we were fired on by Germans from our side of the canal. So I had to deplete my small reserve, which inevitably was small because I had such a wide front to hold, deplete the small reserve to deal with this very vulnerable right flank of mine. And I put my Sergeant Major Gristock in charge of this small force, which was about 10 men, including a wireless operator and a company clerk and various other personnel from company headquarters, to not only hold my right flank, but deal with a German post that had established itself not very far off to my right. And he placed some of his soldiers in position to curtail the activities of that particular post. In fact, they so fatally did that, they wiped them out. And while this was going on, fire came from another German position on our side of the canal, but on the bank. He spotted where this was, and he left two men to give him covering fire, and he went forward armed with a Tommy gun and grenades to dispose of this party, which were in a position behind a pile of stones on the banks of the canal, on the bank of the canal, himself. And when he was about 20 or 30 yards from this position, the occupants which hadn't seen him, he was spotted by another German machine gun post on the enemy side of the canal. who opened fire on him and raked him through and smashed both his knees. And in spite of this, he dragged himself till he got within grenade-lobbing range of this German post on our side of the canal. Then he lay on his side and he lobbed a grenade over the top of this pile of stones, belted the three Germans, turned over on his side, opened fire with his Tommy gun and dealt with a lot of them. So in fact, with that heroic display of his and the good work done by the rest of that little tiny party, the two enemy groups that had crossed the canal were disposed of. And then the reserve company of my own battalion came up and made good that right flank.
They filled in the gap.
They filled in the gap. Well, then I think I passed out there, and I can't quite remember. But the next I remember, I was in a first aid post with my commissar major, who was in a very bad state, and but not too bad not to appreciate some jellified brandy pills that we were both given, and that cheered him up no end. They were delicious, and very very welcoming.
These were medical stores, weren't they?
Yeah, these were rather superior medical stores, which, needless to say, didn't last long, I understood from later on. But we were treated to these with much relish. And then from there on, I was personally evacuated, and so was he. And most sadly, he died about a fortnight later, before he knew that he'd been awarded a VC for that wonderful act of courage he showed during that episode.
Now, you say you were wounded. What was it that wounded you?
A mortar bomb. A mortar bomb.
Was this German mortar fire accurate then on that day?
Yes, it was. Of course, mark you, they were able to get their mortars by this stage in proceedings pretty close to us. And after the initial outburst of fire and their enormous casualties, they knew pretty well where we were. And their mortar fire was very accurate. In fact, by and large, their mortar fire throughout the time that I was involved in active operations was a potent factor.
Now, you say that you let a good number of them get across the bridge before actually opening fire.
Hmm.
Have you got a rough idea of the actual numbers that you allowed across?
Oh, I think there were about 25, 30. And they were not taking up fire positions or anything. They were waiting for the rest of the party to get across before they tell what to do next.
How far away from them were your nearest?
I suppose about under 100 yards.
You're very close indeed.
Oh, yeah. They're jolly well concealed, obviously.
When you were actually wounded, did your batman put any field dressings on you before tying you to the door?
Yes, we all had our field dressings. And I had a field dressing put on each of my wounds. And he was remarkable. He, with great determination, he ripped this door off its hinges, and he wouldn't take any orders from me from then on, except to go where I told him to go. But as far as my own personal well-being was concerned, he did what he thought was best. But then, as I say, I had to go around and see this situation was rectified, and I said, all right, well, you only well put me on a door. I could have gone along with you on one side and another chap on the other side perfectly happily. Now you put me on a door and tie me down, I guess you've got to carry me. So they did that.
Mm.
And until the situation was under control.
How were you eventually evacuated?
Well, I had a pretty hair-raising time of it. I think one was so philosophical about it, one didn't seem to mind unduly. It just took things as they came, but I was evacuated from the regimental first aid post to a larger medical rendezvous where I remember my... I came to then. I don't remember going there. But I remember coming to then. I had a little dog who wouldn't leave me, a little darling little black mongrel. And she was lying on the top of me, preventing anybody getting anywhere near me. And then they cut off my trousers, cut off a trouser leg, which I thought was an awful waste of a reasonable pair of battered trousers. And they get at things better and mutilated them. And my little dog was so concerned about this that they had to put a bag over her and take her away. And I never saw any more. It was too awful. Anyhow, then we were, four of us, were put into an improvised small bus. It was a sort of tradesman's van, really. And we were evacuated in this, and we'd gone some little distance when the... driver brought the vehicle to a very abrupt halt and turned round unceremoniously in the road, and it had opened back, this thing, and there we were looking out the back, and there about 20 yards away was a German Tiger tank sitting in the middle of the road. However, we had a Red Cross painted on the side of this thing, and the chap forbore to fire at us. And on our way we went until we eventually finished up at a station. And it's a hospital train, and they're all stretcher cases on this hospital train. We were where it was, I don't know, but we were taken off to, I think it was Dunkirk we went to first, and we couldn't get out from Dunkirk because there was no hospital train there to evacuate us. And then we went to Boulogne. And there was no hospital train available for us there.
This was in this little truck, was it?
No, this in the train.
Oh, but there's no hospital ship?
Well, there was no hospital ship to take us off from the ports. We were evacuated, we were transferred from this little truck to the hospital train, and then we were moving around in the train from one port to another. And we went to Boulogne, and then there was nothing to take us off there. And so then the train shunted back and then went to Calais. And there was nothing to take us off there. But there was news that there was a hospital ship coming in that night. And so the train was shunted out into no man's land. And this is the most eerie feeling. We were on embankment with, obviously, our Red Cross designations very conspicuous all over the train. And there we were with the German forces on one side and our own forces the other. We could only really tell this for the explosions that were going on either side and none going on where we were. When it became dark, we moved back into Calais. And I remember before we went out from Calais during the daytime, the artist rifles were there, and members of the 60th rifles were there, and there were Thames barges drawing up alongside where the train was with carriers. And these members of these regiments were getting into these carriers as they arrived and driving straight out to confront the Germans on the perimeters of Calais. And I met a great friend of mine there doing just this from my hospital bed in the train. And then we shunted out to the no man's land. After dark, back we came down this mole, and there was this hospital ship, and we were being transferred from the hospital train to the hospital ship when there was a dive bomb attack by Stukas, which had been going on most of the time. And, in fact, it disconnected the base of the mole and the line from the rest of the mole that we were on. And we had a wonderful team of doctors and nurses, all, I think pretty well all, territorial members. There were everybody felt full of admiration for them and the work they did under extremely adverse conditions, because in fact we'd been in this hospital train for 4 days, and there was only dressings available for 24 hours. And so therefore people couldn't be redressed, and a lot of the badly wounded were suffering terribly from gangrene, and the smell was appalling. And so the train couldn't be evacuated with these people on, and so they received orders to go back with us on the hospital ship, which they all refused to obey. And they said, we're going to stay with the defenders of Calais, and we're going on with them, and we're going to go on working for the wounded in France, which they did, and not one of them came with us. There was a full complement of medical staff on this hospital ship, and we were all transferred. I don't think there were any casualties in that stage, and we were all transferred to this hospital ship. People were dying during the course of the time from their wounds, and we were met at Newhaven in the early hours of the next morning. It was the most extraordinary anticlimax I've ever experienced. From all the appalling din, which one become pretty well acclimatised to absolute dead silence, except for the odd seagull.
The voyage was uneventful, was it, across?
The voyage was uneventful. No problem at all. The only problem was when he got the other end, the officers were all sent to Ashridge Park in Berkshire, and the other ranks were sent to Hatfield Park, where, of course, the Hatfield Park was laid out for officers with small rooms, two or three beds in each room, and Ashley's Park was laid out for the other ranks. However, they tried to move us after we got there, but we wouldn't be shifted, in spite of rather dictatorial matrons. My activities with the BEF.
Are there any general observations or concluding remarks you'd like to make?
Well, the first thing I'd pay tribute to is the men and the morale we had in the battalion, which is absolutely wonderful, and it's the most thrilling feeling to experience the spirit of the chaps who are with you. It's intangible, but it's the most exhilarating, potent influence, and it revives. It's the most wonderful revive fire. You never can feel tired. You can never feel depressed when you've got a spirit round you like the spirit that we enjoyed. And the whole thing was treated as a jolly well worthwhile job that had to be done and was going to be done jolly well. That's the first tribute I'd pay. On the other side, I think we were shockingly badly equipped. Some of the equipment we got, we'd not trained with. It only joined us when we were mobilising a few days before we moved over to France. There was a general overall shortage of ammunition. I think our training for war, although we'd had very good commanding officers, both the one that commanded us then as far as training went, and his predecessor, who was a brilliant officer, had trained us remarkably well in what I'd say more orthodox forms of warfare. We hadn't done enough movement at night by transport. We hadn't done enough actual warfare training at night. We luckily were able to do a bit of this while we were in reserve prior to the balloon going up when the Germans came into Belgium. We went in to meet them. But we could have done with a good deal more. I think the commanders were terribly rigid in their attitude. There was remarkable lack of sort of flexibility and remarkable lack of learning about the enemy's techniques, the enemy's type of tactics. I know this because I had previously commanded a battle school, and we used to base our teachings there as much as we possibly could on the German training manuals. And we learned an awful lot from this. And in my battalion, we had trained largely on what we might expect on the other side. I mean, people talk about the Germans being inflexible in their planning, and I'm going to say certainly were. And they were generally pretty lost without an officer. But I think the lack of flexible appreciation by our commanders was deplorable, in actual fact.
So to sum up, then, you would say that you were prepared morally for the conflict, but you weren't prepared intellectually or materially.
That's very shrewd summing up. That's a very shrewd statement of what the situation was. I mean, we had tremendous courage in our men, and the way they held out when the Dunkirk withdrawal was going on, they never got to Dunkirk. They were stopping the Germans interfering with the withdrawal of thousands and thousands and thousands of other people, which they did, and I mean, the battalion was practically wiped out doing it. But such was the morale and such was the determination to put the biggest possible spanner in the Germans' advance that it succeeded in getting the better part of the BF way back to England. But without that sort of determined stand at Bethune, where they finally eliminated, there wouldn't be anything like the number get away from Dunkirk.